as Paul invited us to do in the opening scripture, I'd like to invite you guys, if you would, take out your pen and your paper. Can we turn the wireless on? Take out your pen and your paper, and let's get ready for a test. And wouldn't that be scary if you really had to come to church and take a multiple choice test as we begin? I know I see some very thankful looks on faces. I know mine would be breathing a sigh of relief. Very thankful for that. I am very thankful. Joe, I don't know how you made it up here this morning. It is freezing. But I am so thankful for the heater that Bobby put back here. It feels great. When I was a little kid, school was never one of my favorite activities, and I saw looks of horror when I asked you to take out pen and paper and get ready for one, get ready for a test. But school, I didn't like school very much. You had to get up really early in the morning so you could go out and on days like today stand in the freezing cold waiting on the bus to get there. And the bus, the heater was usually broken, and so it was freezing cold in the bus. And for some reason, I never got along very well with most of the kids on the bus. And so the bus ride to school and back home was usually a pretty miserable experience for me. But once you get to school, you get there and they stick you in this little tiny uncomfortable desk with a chair, and you're supposed to be able to sit there and pay attention all day long. And I don't know, but my attention span is just not that long. And after getting up early in the morning, sometimes you fall asleep and they get mad at you for falling asleep. And I don't understand why, because some of that stuff is just not as exciting as they think it is. The absolute best part about school, however, was PE and recess. Because you got to get out of the classroom and you got to actually go do something that seemed to at least be a little bit worthwhile, something that you might use down the road. Because I have to be honest with you guys here on the front row, never in my entire career as a youth minister have I ever used geometry, ever. But it's one of those classes that you have to take. And you come back in, those PE and recess, it was never quite long enough. You come back in, you sit down in your tiny little uncomfortable desk, and they say, okay, take out your pen and your paper. We're going to have a test. They make you take these tests, and I absolutely hated that part of it. I remember the one and only test that I ever failed in my entire life was in third grade. It was a math test. I don't even remember the questions on it, but I remember it because you had to take any test that you got an F on home and have your parents sign it. And I was so scared to show my parents the test that I got an F on because I was so embarrassed by the fact that I couldn't pass that test. And so I tried to forge my mother's signature. You can imagine how well that went when you go back to the teacher and you hand her the test and she looks at the terrible forgery job of a third grader who didn't quite know how to do cursive and asked, did your mom really see this? Yes, she did. And they know that you're lying. I remember that very vividly. And there's so much pressure in school, especially nowadays, to ace the test. You have to pass the test to pass the class, right? If you can't pass, especially when you get into college and your finals are worth like 80% of your grade, it's kind of ridiculous. You have to pass the test to pass the class. You have to pass the test at the end of high school to get all of the cash to get you into college, right? Now, a lot of parents spend a lot of time worrying about that. Some of you guys have taken the ACT or will take the ACT, what, two or three times? Sometimes even more, trying to improve that grade so that you can get more money when you go to college. Somehow, all of our society, especially in the teenage world, has become focused on tests. And we work so hard towards that goal. I've never seen a generation that's so completely stressed out about schoolwork, about passing that test. It's kind of ridiculous sometimes to think about all of the stress and pressure that we put on you guys for some of that. We stay up hours and hours and hours studying, sometimes all night studying and working because we know how important these tests are to our future, how important they are to where we will eventually end up in our lives. so much work, so much time. And it's all for school. All for stuff that, depending on our career, we're never ever going to use it again. Never ever going to have to see it again. And some of us take our Christian lives a whole lot less seriously than we do those worldly lives, those school lives. It's always amazing to me that for some reason, you know, who we are as a Christian is always the first thing that takes a back seat when it comes to everything else that we have to do in our lives. Whether it be our homework, whether it be studying for that test, whether it be practice, whether it be the games, whether it be working late and you're just too tired to come. Our Christianity is always the first thing we sacrifice, and it absolutely amazes me sometimes. Because, I mean, really, when was the last time that any of us actually stayed up all night reading our Bibles, studying the Scriptures of the Word of God? When was the last time you spent hours and hours and hours studying for a memory verse test? For me, that was about 4 years ago, but they make you do that in school. When was the last time that we actually did anything like that? And our scripture reading tonight invites us to examine ourselves, invites us to ask the very serious question and probably the very uncomfortable question. At least I know it was for me as I was reading this, and probably for most of you, but where are we in that test? Would we pass the test? Is Christ really in our lives? Is He the part of our lives that He should be? Does He take up the amount of space in our lives that He should when we compare it to all of the other stuff that we have going on? And this is what I want us to think about tonight as we go through the rest of this lesson, to consider very seriously the examining ourselves, examining where we are. I want us to do our best to pretend that Paul, in this letter here in Romans chapter 2 is where we're going to be looking. I want us to do our best to pretend that he's writing to you and I, even though it was thousands of years ago today. As we begin the book of Romans, we go through the first couple of chapters there, and he's going through and he's working to show us how different groups of people live. If that makes any sense. He looks at some of the Gentiles. He looks at some of those who think, you know, that they're very religious. He looks at the ways the Gentiles and all of the sins that they're committing. And then we come down here in chapter 2. We get down to about verse 17, and he begins to look at another group of people. He begins to look at those Jews. The ultimate conclusion, it seems, for each of these three groups is that they are guilty before God. You know, he doesn't have just a whole lot of positive in those first couple of chapters as he's listing all of the things that are going on, all of the things that they think that they're doing right, but he says, you still stand guilty before God. You can imagine the shock when this last group that pops up, he references the Jews. They're perhaps, you know, the toughest group to deal with when it comes to all of this, because they are so devoted to their religious heritage, aren't they? Because they were the ones that God gave the law to. Paul himself, I can imagine, would probably have a difficult time writing these words as he looks at it, and because he was a Jew as well, from Benjamin, taught by Gamaliel, a Pharisee, and you know the rest of the story. But his greatest desire was to see that everyone come to know Christ. That all of his fellow Jewish brothers and sisters would come to know Christ. But he knew that there was one huge roadblock, and it was this huge mass of religious ritual that made it impossible for them to see Christ clearly. The irony in this whole story is the reality that God set forth a lot of these rituals to help them gain a deeper knowledge of him. These very rituals that God puts forth are the very ones that get in the way of seeing. Something managed to mess it all up. And I think that was probably human beings, you and I. We have this, you know, uncanny knack and ability to be able to mess stuff up that God puts out there, don't we? What God makes perfect, you and I, we manage to mess it up just about every day of our lives. You know, too many of his contemporaries believed that they were pleasing God because they kept all of the rules and regulations. You know, they were so completely lost in fulfilling the letter of the law, the letter of the regulation, that they would entirely forget about the spirit of the law. We find Jesus in his teachings addressing this exact thing with them, that yes, you know, you've got the letter of it down, but you miss the big picture. You miss the point that I'm trying to get across to you with this. You know, the heart of this passage in Romans that we're looking at, I believe, is that being a Jew is not a matter of racial heritage, or religious ritual. Instead, it's a matter of the heart. It's not the one who keeps the law best, but the true Jew are those who reflect the teaching of the laws in their hearts. Being able to reflect those teachings, take the teachings of the laws and internalize them and be able to reflect them back in a way that would show God to everybody that they were around. And the Jews did a fantastic job of messing this up. They did a fantastic job of what we call today teaching towards the test and making sure that, you know, you can stay up all night and you can memorize it all, and then the very next day you forget it. It's absolutely worthless to you in the end. Like any good speaker, though, Paul, as he begins here in verse 17, he begins with the positive aspects of what's going on. We look in verse 17. He says that now if you call yourself a Jew, the very first place he goes to in his letter is their name. You know, these were God's chosen people. They were privileged among the nations because God chose them. They had the law of God. They had Moses. They had Abraham, who was the father. They had all of the poets, all of the prophets. All of these people belonged in the Jewish faith, the Jewish persuasion. And because of that, being a Jew was a big thing, was a big deal to them. They would often introduce themselves. It would be, "Hi, my name is Bryce Kidwell. I'm a Jew." That was a big deal because there was a lot put behind that name. He also, in verse 18, looks at this. He says that if you rely on the law and brag about your relationship to God, if you know His will and approve of what is superior because you're instructed by the law. So he turns first to their name, but then he turns to their book. The Greeks, they had Plato, they had Aristotle, but the Jews, they had the law of God. In the religious world, you can't top that. You can't top having the law of God on your side. They were instructed in the law. They knew right and wrong, and they didn't mind telling you about it either. They were the very first ones to tell you what you were doing wrong, all of the things that you were messing up with, because they knew it all. They were Jews. They knew God's law. So their name and their book, and they also go this way. It says that if you're convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of infants, because you have the law, the embodiment of knowledge and truth. So we look at their name, we look at the book that they have, we also look at their works, all of the things that they're doing, their claims of the things that they're doing well. They're teachers, they're guides to the blind. All of these four claims, and there's nothing wrong with these four claims in and of themselves, are there? They're good if they're used right. It's a very respectable claim, but performance and follow-through is a completely different story, isn't it? When it comes down to it. Looking at this list, I don't know about you, but it seems a little bit superficial, doesn't it? If you're looking at it, yes, you have a good name, you have a good book. You claim that you do good works. These are all kind of outside things, aren't they? It's a very outwardly focused view on life, view on their religion, view on who they were as Jews. It all seems to be saying, you know, kind of look at me. Look at all the good I'm doing. Look at who I am. These things didn't touch the hearts of the Jewish people, did they? They didn't get down into the heart of the matter. These things were very, very easy to be fake about, to not be real about, not be, you know, genuine in what you're doing. Without a change of heart, though, I believe that an advantage, These three advantages of the Jews can easily become disadvantages if we don't allow God to change our hearts. Paul begins the next few verses with five charges against the Jews. He says, "You who teach others, do you not teach yourselves?" The answer, of course, is yes. Yes, you teach yourselves. You tell others what to do. But you don't live up to your own standards, do you? It's easy to tell people what to do. They're very good at it, but you're not living up to your own standards. He asks, you who preach against stealing, do you steal again? The answer is yes. They were preaching against stealing, but yet they stole from the widows at every chance they got. His third question, you say that people should not commit adultery. Do you yourself commit adultery again? The answer is yes. It's easier to preach against immorality than it is to stay out of the trouble yourself. He asks again, you who abhor idols, do you rob temples? Yes. You can preach against idolatry, you can hate idolatry, but they were hanging out in the temple with prostitutes. It doesn't quite go together, does it? What they're teaching, what they're preaching, what they're claiming doesn't quite follow with the way that they're living. You who brag about the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? You know, it's always worse when religious people act like hypocrites, isn't it? When the people who claim to be Christians, when the people who claim to be religious in their lives are the ones breaking God's law, for some reason it always looks a whole lot worse than somebody who doesn't claim to be a Christian. So what's the point in all of these five things? What is our point? It's that religious people are very good at telling others what to do. Unfortunately, they're also very good at practicing what they condemn in others. This is their disadvantage as Jewish people. Not that they knew the law, not that they claimed to be teachers of all of these people, but it's that they didn't live up to their message, that they weren't following through on all of these claims. Notice how Paul sums it up in verse 24. He says, as it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. It's a quote from Isaiah. As it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. As a Christian, I can't think of a more reprehensible accusation against me. I don't know about you, but it hurts me when I sit down and think of how guilty I really am. As I was reading through these passages this week, it hurt. It hurt me on the inside when I was thinking about all of these things and all of the ways that I pretend sometimes like I'm a Christian, like I claim the name of Christ, but yet here I am not living that out in my own life. Paul continues in verse 25 and following with one more charge, but I want to pause right here and ask us to consider ourselves. Because this passage, for me, hits way too close to home. And we can sit here in agreement with Paul. We can be Paul's champion, shaking our head. Yes, Paul, you're right. And everything that you're saying, I can't believe those silly Jews. How could they live like that? But where do we fit in all of this? It seems a little distant, I have to admit, because this was written, you know, a few thousand years ago. But can you imagine if Paul was writing this to Christians today, what would he say? That's a question I like to ask myself. What would Paul write to me today? Would he write something like this? The church membership doesn't save. The Lord's Supper doesn't save. Praying twice a day doesn't save. Superior Bible knowledge, religious ritual, and claiming the name Christian isn't going to save you. religious rituals don't save. And as Christians, we really hate to hear these things because, honestly, it's kind of what we pride ourselves on, isn't it? We pride ourselves on being members of churches. We pride ourselves on taking the Lord's Supper as often as we're commanded. We pride ourselves on praying as much as we're supposed to. We pride ourselves on knowing the Bible as much as we possibly could, and even more than you, right? We pride ourselves sometimes on our religious ritual. And it hurts, I think, for Paul to be sitting here and writing this to us. But as he's writing it to us, I think he's inviting us to see here that it's none of this stuff makes any difference. It doesn't make any difference at all. Not that these things are bad. Don't get me wrong. But it doesn't make any difference unless you've allowed the words of Christ to truly touch your heart and to change your life. Being a good Christian on the outside doesn't do you any good. Notice in verse 28 and 29, he says that a man is not a Jew if he is only one outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Jew if he is one inwardly, excuse me. And circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not by the written code. That being a Jew on the outside doesn't do any good. Circumcision is much less about the physical act than it is the transformation that takes place inside your heart. Maybe if we change the words a little bit, it would make it a little bit more real. That a man is not a Christian if he is only one outwardly. Nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Christian if he is one inwardly. And circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not by the religious rituals. The transformation that has to take place on the inside of our hearts. Edward Guest wrote this. He says that I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I'd rather one walk with me than merely tell me the way. The eye is a better pupil and more willing than the ear. Fine counsel is confusing, but example is always clear. The best of all the preachers are the men who live their creeds, for to see good put in action is what everybody needs. I soon can learn to do it if you'll let me see it done. I can watch your hands in action, but your tongue too fast may run. And the lecture you deliver may be very wise and true, but I'd rather get my lessons by observing what you do. For I might understand you and misunderstand you and the high advice that you give, but there's no misunderstanding how you act and how you live. One good man teaches many. Men believe what they behold. One deed of kindness noticed is worth 40 that are told. Who stands with men of honor learns to hold his honor dear. For right living speaks a language which to everyone is dear. Though an able speaker charms me with his eloquence, I say, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. There's a whole lot of truth in that little passage right there. And we have to let the gospel, we have to let Christ transform our hearts, not just what we claim to be, not just what we say we are, not just all of the things that we do, but it is a change on the inside. That being a Christian is much less about the name and looking down our noses at everybody who's not a Christian than it is about a Christ-like change of heart. My favorite line in that little poem that I read is that men believe what they behold. I tell the kids all the time, the greatest sermon that you will ever preach in this life is the one that you live every day. The one that you live as you interact with your coworkers, the one that you live as you go with all of your friends at school. They hear the things that we say. They see the things that we do. Most of them see the shirts that you'll wear that say Sunset Crew on them. our actions speak so much louder than words. If we're to sit here tonight and to claim the name of Christ and to claim that we wear the name Christian, we have to live it out in our lives. So the question tonight is, in what are you trusting for your eternal salvation? It's easy to trick ourselves into believing that religious ritual is going to get us where we're going to go, that getting everything right is what gets us into heaven. And if we're not careful, that's exactly where we'll find ourselves living as Christians. Maybe a more accurate question then tonight is, who are you trusting for your eternal salvation? I want to leave you with just five words tonight. Only Jesus, and Jesus only. Only Jesus can save you. So put your trust in Jesus only. If there is anything that we can do for you tonight, if there is anything that we need to pray for you about tonight, if there is anything that we need to be thankful for with you tonight, we invite you to come down to the front now as we stand and as we sing.